Probably nobody around the table understands rural America more carefully and clearly than Secretary Salazar. Tell all of you, he grew up in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, probably as rural and poor an area as exists in the Rocky Mountain, the whole of the Rocky Mountain region. And his is the American success story. It's an extraordinary story of political will, political achievement, and political accomplishment. And Ken, you have to bring all of that to bear to solve these issues and reach to the siting questions. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Senator Wirth. And as I was listening to Senator Reid talk about how the federal government has taken on major issues and has been a part of those solutions in the past, I was thinking, Glenn, about the REA and how in my own lifetime and in our house in southern Colorado, we didn't get electricity out to our place until 1981, so just a few short years ago. And so I remember Senator Reid's story about Searchlight and what it was like living as he was growing up without the modern-day conveniences that we have with electricity and the energy that we so depend on. And so this is a very important and timely conference. Let me just say, I believe that the Department of Interior can play some significant roles, first with respect to siting and secondly with respect to transmission. We obviously own 20% of the landmass of the United States, 1.75 billion of the Outer Continental Shelf in acreage. There are huge energy, renewable energy potentials in wind out in the Atlantic, huge solar potential in the southwestern part of the state, and a whole host of other items that are on the portfolio of renewable energy. And whether ultimately we get to 25 by 25 or 30 by 30, or as Vice President Gore might say, maybe even beyond that, I think so much of it is dependent on transmission, because it doesn't do any good for us to take the 85% of the landmass in Nevada, where we have the sun shining almost every day in Nevada, and produce a tremendous amount of solar power. I mean, some companies are talking about 200 and 300 and 350 megawatt solar power plants out in the desert, but there aren't a lot of people out there to consume that energy that's produced from that solar power. And so our big question becomes, how do we get the energy that is produced from those areas to the places where it's going to be consumed in Southern California and Los Angeles and North Albuquerque, wherever it is that we have to transmit that power? So I think, just based on my work with Senator Bingaman and with Senator Dorgan and President Clinton and others over the years, that we can do a lot more than we have been doing. You know, the experts, the scientists tell us that we can get to the point where we're producing 20% of our energy from wind alone by the year 2030. They tell us that by the year 2020, we could put another 10% of our energy as we harness the power of the sun. And that's not even beginning to tap the potential that we have with respect to geothermal or other sources of renewable energy. But at the end of the day, unless we are able to solve this juggernaut that we are in, Glenn, and deal with the transmission issue, we simply are going to be standing in place 5 and 10 years from now. And so I think it is appropriate for this center and for the Congress and for President Obama to be absolutely focused like a laser beam on what we do to grapple with this issue of transmission.
Thank you very much, Senator Salazar, and you certainly, Secretary Salazar. You certainly have an enormous jurisdiction, and for those of you who are watchers of this, if we can get the Law of the Sea Treaty ratified by the Senate, its jurisdiction is going to increase by just about double, I think, in size. Isn't that right? Another set of responsibilities. As you mentioned, wind, the home of probably the greatest wind opportunity are the Dakotas. Byron Dorgan has watched this very carefully, is also the lead appropriator for the all of the issues that we're talking about. Byron, how do all of these pieces fit together in an appropriations process, and how do you deal with wind and a large coal constituency at the same time? Senator Dorgan.
Well, I was just thinking that Secretary Salazar mentioned the REA, which was, of course, a government program that brought electricity to rural America and released an unbelievable amount of productivity across this country back in the 1930s, and was controversial at the time, but a very large government program. We used to have an old codger who said, if it weren't for the REA, we'd still be watching television by candlelight. It's interesting I was thinking about wind and renewables and oil. In oil, the problem is the supply is over there and the need is over here. That's essentially, and we're unbelievably dependent on a supply that exists elsewhere under the sands. And so renewables have the same characteristics in our country. I mean, North Dakota is, according to the Department of Energy, the Saudi Arabia of wind. We have greater wind potential than any place in our country. But we also have stranded capability because we don't need it. And when we produce it, we build the turbines and so on and put them up and gather the energy from that wind. We have to send it someplace where it's needed. So the renewables are over there, and the need is over here. That's what drives the requirement. If we're going to maximize the ability to produce renewable energy, there is an absolute requirement that we connect America. I mean, we're looking for terms here. There needs to be a Connect America transmission system, and we don't have it. Some parts of the system are modernized. Some parts are not. There's no central plan. And I think the issue that the key to giving us the opportunity to do that, all that we can do here, is to build a modern interstate transmission system. And the keys are, as I said before this morning, three things. One is planning, the second is siting, and the third is pricing. And if you don't solve all three of those, it can't work and won't work. If you can solve those three, and I believe we can, and I believe we will with this kind of an approach, then I think we'll build a system that allows us to produce energy where we can produce it, in a renewable energy category, and then move it where it's needed. And that's going to dramatically reduce our vulnerability on foreign oil, and at the same time produce a lot of jobs and begin to protect this country's environment.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to go to Denise Bode as head of the Wind Association and ask her to frame the issues faced by the opportunities for wind. And what challenges, then, does that raise for the Department of Energy and the third in our line of Nobel excellence over here on my left? Denise, and then to Steve Chu.
Thank you so much. And again, I want to thank you all for putting this forum together. This is absolutely critical to our future as a country, is getting this right, because every time anybody, any consumer, goes to their home, they've got something plugged in, every single plug at home. So it's going to make such a huge difference, not only to the smallest person out there, but to the largest business. I want to also give you some good news. We've been talking about all the problems. I want to tell you some good news. Last year, we added 8,300 megawatts of wind power in the United States. We led the country in adding new capacity from wind, and that was doubling over the last 3 years, and we're fully prepared to double it over the next 3 years. We added 70 manufacturing facilities. We're talking about, 85,000 jobs, 35,000 added last year. So the opportunity and the possibility out there is unbelievable, and we are prepared to move forward, getting the job done. I want to also thank everyone around this table, because everyone participated, from the president down to every member of Congress, the folks in this room. I want to thank you for what you've done to buy us some time in this near term in the stimulus package to keep this momentum going. It's so critical what you did, and our industry is so grateful for that work, and we are working right now to continue to manufacture those parts and to get the wind industry going in the near future. But what we have to have is not just the near-term solutions, we have to have the long-term solutions, and that's what we're here talking about today. We're talking about the need to send a signal to the business community, and Senator Dorgan mentioned it at breakfast this morning, a long-term signal that will provide the kind of certainty that the business community, that members here like our utility folks like Mike Morris at AEP need, that Glenn English will need, that the businesses that are manufacturing these parts, like Cardinal Fastener, who's one of our facilities that builds bolts, that built bolts for the Golden Gate Bridge and for the Statue of Liberty, is now building bolts for the wind industry. Those kind of people need certainty to add people, to add jobs, to spend the billions of dollars that's going to be necessary to build out this infrastructure, to build the wind farms, to build the solar panels, and to build the transmission, which, as a former state regulator, let me tell you, it's $1 million a mile to build that transmission. And we have to have that certainty, make it done. What's going to give us that certainty? We believe fundamentally it's critically important to ask for and to receive a renewable electricity standard that makes the difference. I think what President Obama has said is critically important. It provides that certainty, that signal, unlike what has happened in the past with the renewable industry where we provide a tax credit and then we don't renew it, then we provide it. I mean, it's like Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown, you know? I mean, you just get going and then it stops. So we have to have that. And we have to have an elimination to the policy barriers that are out there that are keeping us balkanized as an electric grid. I mean, I watched firsthand as each one, we have 115 balancing centers in the U.S. trying to keep the grid moving. We've got to have this interstate highway, this green interstate highway, to get the job done, to move forward the United States. It is critically important. In terms of getting the transmission done, there's three things that we talk about in this report. One is making sure that the cost allocation, that the pay for, is coordinated and managed more at the federal level. We have to work on getting the siting issues right. And that does mean you have to have state input. And as a state regulator, let me tell you, I did provide that kind of input in our region. But you also have to have the planning done. And the planning on an interconnection-wide basis is critically important, and getting it done quickly is essential. Right now, we have 300,000 megawatts of wind projects waiting to go online if we can build the transmission, if we can only get the transmission built. Now, we're still being able to build projects now, and we will for the next 2 or 3 years, but we got to get hot now to get that transmission built. So I wanted to tell you, and this goes to Van Jones, who's always got the best sound bites, and I'm so glad that I had people between you and I when we spoke. But you were talking about repowering America. Well, repowering empowers. And that's what we have to do as a country, is we have to empower this new green economy.
Thank you very much, Denise. We're delighted to have Steve Chu joining us from the University of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Steve, thank you very much. As you all know, the Nobel laureate when he was at Bell Labs, and delighted to have that extraordinary vision now part of this. What kind of problems technologically have to get solved, Steve?
Thank you, Senator Wirth. Let me start specifically with transmission and distribution. Siting problems are not a technical problem, it's not a science technology problem, it's a technical problem. And that's certainly the biggest bottleneck, but let me put a few science and technology problems on the table. There is a technology of high-voltage DC transmission that the United States is just beginning to install. Europe is ahead of us. Asia is ahead of us. This is much more efficient transmission lines going above the 765 kilovolt transmission lines we have today that could be much more efficient. I'm hearing projects. That has to be thought of. When you transmit high-voltage DC, we actually need to develop better mechanisms for stepping up the voltage and stepping down the voltage. So you can actually have off-ramps as this power crosses over other states so that you can bring it down more easily. That's a technological problem, and the Department of Energy fully intends to invest in that. We talk about the great wind resources and the great solar resources in the United States, and the United States is blessed with enormous resources. But we also have to remember that renewable resources like wind and solar are transient. They go up and down. At the level of 2.8%, roughly what we are today, that's okay. But imagine a world of 15, 25, 30% renewable going up and down. That's a bigger problem, a much bigger problem. Certainly, that's why we need a long-distance transmission system to port the energy, because somewhere in the United States, whether it's the Great Lakes, the North Dakota, the Pacific Northwest, Texas, the wind will be blowing. But we don't have large-scale power storage yet. We should start to invest heavily in pumped hydro storage. We should start to look at compressed air storage. So when the wind blows, because in the Dakotas, there aren't hydro sources, but there is a capability of putting in compressed air storage, bringing that compressed air up, burning it with natural gas to create electricity much more efficiently. The distribution system. Think about in the future where we have two-way flows. We have photovoltaics beginning on buildings and rooftops of homes and in warehouses. And you can imagine easily a day where you're going to have two-way flows, where you're suddenly giving back energy, and oops, a cloud goes over, and it disappears, and then it comes back again. So this is a much smarter grid that we need. The electrical system we have today is essentially analogous to the water system. We put water in a water tower, and it flows downhill into our homes and businesses. We put electrical energy at high voltage, and it flows downhill. We have now presently a technology that can switch this electricity. But we need a very, very smart grid, which is now sensitive to what the electricity is doing on a one-cycle basis, 1/60th of a second. The biggest bottleneck there is the fact that American industry has not yet developed a standard. You imagine these very large power transformers, digital relays, and such, they have to be talking to each other very, very high bandwidth so they can coordinate it. The American industry has not yet had a standard. It's been kind of stalled. Somewhere in NIST, I think we have an issue also, and I've already begun to look into this. What we really need is to lock these people up in a room and say, come out with a standard in a few weeks. Rather than trying to have one company and another company jockey for position. Time is wasting. And until there's a standard for this high-speed switching equipment, people will be afraid to install a smart grid. Boulder, Colorado is starting this now. It's a great act of courage because they know full well it may be when that new standard is developed 3 years from now or 1 year from now, it may be obsolete. So we've got to get a standard. The Department of Energy has been entrusted with a lot of loan authority. Another thing that I've been looking at very hard in my first month in office is how to accelerate this loan authority so that America can make the right investments. And we have a plan going forward where we can reduce what could have been years down to months. And we feel very strongly that this thing will work. But I'm beginning to look at the details, the need for a quick electrical standard, faster loan vetting and approval, all of these things. And I share with all of you around the room that we need to move with a sense of urgency, because going back to the opening remarks of Vice President Gore, all the news on climate over the last half dozen years has been essentially bad news. The legacy we leave to our children and grandchildren, we just imagine what will be 50 years from now, 40 years from now, where if we don't act now and start acting with all seriousness, they can go back and say, what were these people thinking? So we've got to start acting.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I'm going to go to the state of New York now and ask first Governor Pataki, who's had an enormous amount of experience dealing with these potential opportunities, how, in fact, do they become a reality? And then ask Robert Kennedy if he might talk about the kind of clean energy businesses that get spawned. That then moves us to toward a more consumer orientation, and I would like to go to Lee Scott from there. So, Governor Pataki, if you could, over to you, sir. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Senator Wirth, and it's an honor to be a part of this panel. And let me congratulate the leadership on the tremendous progress on energy that has been made thus far. We all, I think, are aware of the needs, but what we haven't talked about is one of the biggest single impediments to achieving a national transmission system that allows us to access these renewables, and that is, how do you permit the actual transmission line? And let me tell you, after 12 years as governor, there are a lot of contentious issues, but you try to run a wire through somebody's community, and that becomes as contentious as you could possibly have. You know, if you were to go to a community and do a poll on the stimulus bill, it might be 50-50, 70-30. But tell someone you're going to run wires through the community that come from one state and go through to another state. You don't have to take a poll. No one is going to be for it. And what is missing is the ability of those who desire to build this transmission system to actually get the approval and the permit to do it. It takes years, it takes hundreds of millions of dollars, and at best, the outcome is uncertain. So I'm going to get in a little trouble in some quarters by agreeing with Majority Leader Reid. that I think the federal government has a critical role in this regard. Right now, you have to get local approvals, state approvals, but what we need is a federal permitting process, not one that's authoritarian, one that works in partnership with the states so that the states see benefit to their constituencies when a national transmission system comes through their community. Secretary Chu talked about on and off ramps. You know, when the highway system was built, at first everyone wanted it because they had that off ramp. They could get to work quicker. They could get their goods to market sooner. They could see their property values grow. We need to help states by having on and off ramps so states that want to raise their renewable standards can access them from areas that have those tremendous resources. But ultimately, when it comes to permitting, if it's left to a state-by-state basis, for all the money, for all the technology, it is not going to happen. We have a model with natural gas pipelines where the FERC was authorized to do that. We need to work with the states, but ultimately grant that authority, and I'm reluctant to say it with the chairman sitting next to me, to the FERC so that these transmission lines that we all want and we all know we need, in fact, ultimately get built.
Thank you very much, Governor. And we had quite a discussion of this earlier this morning with John Willinghoff and Fred Butler, and if we have time, we'll come back to some of that. Robert, do you want to speak about some of the opportunities that are out there? And then I want to go to Lee Scott as to how those opportunities then get spread to a very broad American public. Robert Kennedy?
I'd like to just start by saying, Senator Wirth, that during 25 years as an environmental advocate, this is probably the most heartening morning that I've ever had. To hear all these national leaders talking about solving these issues in a way that I think a lot of us have been talking about a long time. I'm on the board, in addition to working for NRDC and Waterkeepers, I'm on the board of the one of the largest green tech venture capital firms in the country. One of our companies, BrightSource, on Thursday signed a contract with Southern California Edison to build a 1.3 gigawatt solar thermal plant in Southern California. 8 months ago, we signed another contract, the same company, with Pacific Gas and Electric for another gigawatt of solar thermal. So that's 2.3 gigawatts of solar thermal that we're going to build, bring online within the next 2 years. We're building the plant cheaper than you can build. It's bigger than most nuke plants. We're building it cheaper than a nuke plant. We're building it cheaper than a coal plant. We're building it cheaper than a gas plant. We're building it a lot faster. Once we build it, as Vice President Gore said, the energy is free forever. You don't have to go to Saudi Arabia and punch holes in the ground, bring the oil up, refine it, ship it across the Atlantic with a military escort, get in periodic wars in Mesopotamia and other places, and then delivered across the country. The electrons are hitting our country for free every day. If we build this infrastructure to pick them up, we can put them into the lines. If we were to build this out across the country, we could provide 100% of the energy needs in this country for about $750 billion. This is theoretical. You know, I'm not saying you could do solar thermal for the whole country, but you'd mix it with wind and other, about $750 billion. That's less than we spend on oil every year, on foreign oil, than we export out of this country for foreign oil every year. We gave that $700 billion to Wall Street, and people say, well, it'll take generations to pay back. Actually, it'll only just take 1 year without foreign oil. What we need is a marketplace, and that's what everybody's saying. That's what Vice President Gore said. We need an open marketplace that does what a market is supposed to do, which is to reward good behavior, which is efficiency, and to punish bad behavior, which is inefficiency and waste. Right now, we have a marketplace that is rigged to favor the dirtiest, filthiest, poisonous, most expensive fuels from hell. We need to design a marketplace that rewards the clean, cheap fuels from heaven. Now, we can do this very quickly, and I want to give you a couple of examples. We built a national grid, a national backbone for the internet in 1979 called the ARPANET. And in 1980, a year later, there were fewer than 500 PCs in this country, and IBM was saying it was a dead-end technology. Well, now every American has a PC because we had a marketplace. And what happened to the cost of information, of bits and bytes? It plummeted to almost nothing. That's the same thing that will happen to electrons if we build a national grid for electricity in this country. In 1996, President Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, which opened up the telecommunications grid. It spawned a telecommunications revolution in this country. That's why we have an iPod. This morning, before I came down here, I saw on TV an advertisement for a company that provides unlimited long distance and local calling for $18 a year. That's what's going to happen to the cost of energy if we build a national marketplace that operates the way that a marketplace is supposed to do. Now, it may not be one whole grid system, because really there are three grids in this country. There's an eastern grid, there's a western grid, and there's a Texas grid. All of them are big enough. All of them have adequate wind and solar resources to split among each other. And that may be a more sensible way to do it. I'm not sure. But what we need to do is to make sure that the market rules are aligned with our national interests and with the global interest of saving our planet. We need to make sure that utilities can make money by getting their consumers to conserve energy, and that their money, that their profits are not dependent on them selling as much energy as possible. And then we need to open up the grid so that everybody can get on it. If you have a solar panel on your roof and you're not home for one part of the day and your house is generating more energy than it's using, you ought to be able to sell that back to the grid and get market rates for it. There's no state where you can do that today. 36 states will buy it back from you, but all of them limit how much, and none of them will give you market rates. If we do that, we will make every American into an energy entrepreneur, every home into a power plant, and we can power this country from American initiative and entrepreneurship and energy rather than Saudi oil.
Robert, thank you very much. Lee, if you could hang on just a minute. There was one comment in this theme running through this, which is changing the rules in energy and how we have learned about changing the rules from telecommunications. Nobody has done that more in the last decade and a half than Ed Markey, who now has the energy responsibility. But Ed, what's the parallel between what we learned just very recently and what we have to do now? Then I'm going to go to Lee Scott and Andy Stern as to how all of this relates to consumers and individuals. But Ed Markey.
I think that's the perfect analogy, Tim. You and I and Al joined the Telecommunications Committee when people wanted to be on the Appropriations or the Ways and Means Committee. And that's now 32, 34 years ago when we joined that committee. But let's fast forward to 1996. President Clinton, Vice President Gore have a vision. And that vision is to create a broadband network across our country. In 1996, not one home in America had broadband, not one. Now, after the Telecommunications Act passed, by creating a new marketplace, and Al and I used to talk about this on a weekly basis, we now have a revolution that's created a new vocabulary in the United States. It's called eBay, Amazon, YouTube, Google, thousands and thousands of companies, because we got the marketplace right, and it unleashed this venture capital revolution. Now, all across America, there's a generation of Sergey Brins and Larry Pages waiting for us to get the marketplace right. They're waiting in their venture capital firms. They're waiting in their master's degrees program at Caltech and MIT, but schools all across America. They're ready to go. The green generation is ready to unleash this second revolution. And so I think that we should be optimistic that 10 years from now, we'll look back at this year and next as that pivotal point where we created the equivalent of the broadband revolution. And by the way, that revolution created 3 million new jobs in the United States. And I think that 3 million is a conservative estimate as to what we could create if we got this marketplace correct. But we have to make sure that we create these bridges so that they're not bridges to nowhere. We can't be creating transmission systems out to coal country. we've got to make sure they're going out to where the renewables are being created. And we can't, and we have to also make sure that if the electricity is being created from renewables, that it has a place to get in. So as Byron was saying, back in the 1930s, urban America decided that they were going to fund the construction of electric lines to bring it out to rural America. Now we have to decide how to get it in from the prairies into the cities, in from the desert, and off of the rooftops of Americans into the electricity grid. So if we think as this analogy to the Telecom Act, as you have pointed out, Tim, very wisely, we found a way of empowering the ends of the networks so that we weren't tied to these centralized decisions that were made in the telecommunications industry for 100 years. And that's pretty much where we are right now. Although there already was a prodigy. There already was the early iteration of AOL out in the system, but they were just waiting to be unleashed. And so Denise already pointed it out. They have already had great progress, but the potential is unlimited. And I'll tell you why we're at this critical point. Nancy Pelosi has made it her flagship issue. Harry has given this tremendous leadership to it. The president, before the bank collapsed, when he was asked what was his number one issue, he said climate change and energy policy. So we're at this tremendous point. And all you have to know is that Denise came from the American Petroleum Association to the American Wind Association, and that I can make, and this is a statement I thought I'd never make, that I can end my statement by saying, I agree with everything that Boone Pickens said. And I never thought I'd say that. So thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Congressman. And I think you've really laid out, in summary, what we're talking about here in terms of the transmission issues, in a way, a case study of the overall shift in rules and shift that we have to take on in the country, not dissimilar from models that we've had over the last 150 years, most recently in telecommunications. Nobody in the retail world has taken more advantage of, understood the opportunities of this very significant change in the telecommunications area. Lee, if you could talk about that from the Walmart point of view, and then we can go to Andy Stern and Rick Fedrizzi if we could do that. But first, start with you, Andy. Lee, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting Walmart to participate. It is interesting for us to be here because we do feel like we represent the consumer, average working people in the United States. When we embarked on sustainability back in 2005, it was a very interesting discussion because the number one thing that was discussed on one side was that our customers really don't care. And on the other side was that none of the NGOs would even come and visit with us because they didn't trust us. So it has been an interesting journey, and what we have found out is that average working people in America do care, but they cannot afford to pay more. And if you look at the current environment that we are in, if we legislate solutions to these issues that cause people who have to stretch every dollar every week to pay more to sacrifice, they just cannot do it. What we have found at Walmart, though, is that where we give a choice that allows people, working people, to both save money and to do things that are good for the environment, they pick the things that will then save money and are good for the environment. Compacted fluorescent light bulbs, new packaging. Just because they don't have money doesn't mean they don't care. They do care. They just can't afford to be as aggressive as the people in this room in reflecting that care in their purchases. So we have built a better relationship with our customers by embarking on this. We have, at the same time, improved our image among those people who typically are not our customers but seem to have a great deal of power. We have created a better business, and we are operating for less dollars. We have a new store in Henderson, Nevada that is using 40% less electricity than our current stores, and we're very excited about what that is going to mean to us. In our truck fleet, we improved our fuel mileage by 25%. By using individualized systems, We also were able to reduce our mileage driven by 90 million miles, and by reducing packaging, saved another 7% for almost a little short of a 40% savings in total fuel used for the same number of cases. So those kinds of things, President Clinton, that you talked about that are here today, I think are important for us as businesses to embrace. We have on March the 1st, thanks to Boone and his ability to twist an arm, the delivery of our first LNG trucks. Boone, so please don't call me anymore. We have on the market, on the road today, 5 hybrid assisted trucks. And on a test track today, we actually have a hybrid truck that below 40 miles an hour runs on the batteries. And then one of the great synergies we have is we have 5 trucks coming on this next month, which will actually run on the brown grease, the oils that we fry the chicken in the deli. We have 5 trucks that will be running on that, and we are looking at taking the remainder of that grease and running an 80-20 blend with diesel fuel. So actually, Vice President Gore...
Sounds to me like you're using too much grease in that cafeteria.
Well, I was going to say it is going to be an opportunity. You'll be able to eat fried chicken and save the environment. And we'll be working on our marketing on that. But I'm going to say 2 last things. First of all, Speaker Pelosi talked about vision. Business has freedoms that government doesn't have. I understand that. But to me, if I could look back to 2005, what we had was a vision. We had a crystal clear vision of where we wanted to go. But we did not have a crystal clear vision of the route we would have to take to get there. And I think that's critical in this discussion. We know where we want to go. And we cannot wait until we have every absolute turn figured out before we start the journey. And it does take courage, and it does take some capacity to be criticized. So I think, you know, I'm excited about this. I think ultimately, I think this is good for our customers. And the last thing I would say is, as we think about these things, and you're in a meeting and somebody says, but this is only going to cost $5 a week more, remember that there are people that if it costs them $5 a week more, that means that they're not going to buy something for their children, or they're not going to buy medication, or they're not going to participate in the wealth of this American life that we all enjoy. So we also have to do this in a way that somehow protects those people who make up the bulk of this country and make this country what it is.
Lee, thank you very much. I say, Lee has just announced his retirement at Walmart, but let me say that we're not going to let you get away. You know, it's absolutely essential that you remain as deeply engaged in this as possible, and we look forward to working with you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Andy Stern has thought deeply about the issues of justice and how the opportunities of this new economy deal and relate to an American workforce that's certainly threatened or under pressure today as perhaps never before. Andy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. And as a organization that's somewhat of a latecomer to this, I just want to say to have all these people who were out there before this was popular, who got challenged about the science or their integrity, it really is an honor to be here. And for Senator Reid and Speaker Pelosi and President Obama to sort of see this now all come together with this opportunity, we owe all of you an incredible debt of gratitude. Let me just say that for all of us in this room, I think we do appreciate, and I think it's set up on the sign that this is a huge opportunity to not only create jobs we desperately need right now, but really to think about building a new economy. And I would say we're not quite yet there with the American people understanding the opportunities that are here. So I think, first of all, we just need to be thoughtful that we have at times oversold things. I think we oversold high-tech jobs. We oversold trade as kind of the answer. And I think what it means is that if we really want to maximize the opportunity here, we have to think about how we're going to create American jobs and how we're going to benefit this country very specifically. And so for that, I think it's very simple. We need a plan. And we need to appreciate, particularly when we get to weatherization and retrofitting in some of the lower end parts of this job creation. You know, what John Podesta in another study at CAP showed, that when you look at procurement in the federal government, and Vice President Gore and President Clinton tried to deal with this while they were in office, 80% of the jobs that are provided from our current procurement are low-wage jobs. 20%, one of every five jobs, are poverty jobs provided by procurement from the federal government. Most of them have virtually no significant health care benefits. And so good intentions are not enough here. We have to be intentional. And so just for me, there are three things we need to think about for the legislators. You know, one is, as we do in defense contracting, how do we consider these really investments in critical industries so that we guarantee there's a certain amount of domestic base of production and a domestic workforce? And I'm not simply trying to be protectionist, but I do think we understand what a critical industry is and what is more critical than our own energy security here. Two is, we need to build on the Green Jobs Act and all the issues about hiring, training, and workforce development, but we have to be thoughtful of not accepting sort of anecdotal, one-off solutions as something we can do on scale. And I think we have a tremendous obligation and responsibility right now with all the money that Congress has appropriated to really be serious about, you know, not highlighting one thing here and another thing there, but building, as Lee Scott knows, a system, you know, that actually creates the good jobs, the training, the career advancement we need. And three is, I think we're going to have to set some meaningful job standards, meaningful standards, so they are good jobs, whether it's what Maryland does about living wages, whether it's what we do about prevailing wages in Davis-Bacon or predetermined wages of project labor agreements or community benefits. If we are not purposeful and intentional, the idea that these will be good jobs, particularly in certain parts of this job creation, is not necessarily going to be true, and we cannot afford to sell the American people something that turns out not to be true. This is the opportunity to create a new economy. It really is the chance to create the jobs that our kids and our grandkids can live the American dream, and I think we have the opportunity to do it, and I'm glad to be here.
Andy, thank you very much. Andy is our landlord at the UN Foundation, and we are privileged to be in a gold standard building, and Rick Fedrizzi from the U.S. Building Council is here. Rick, do you want to give us your window on how rapidly the building stock is changing and how rapidly it can change?
Sure. Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here with all of you. The U.S. Green Building Council, really, part of the discussion that I've heard over and over again this morning really gets to the fact of, how do you take this big macro idea and get it into the hearts and soul of the American people so that they can understand it? And in our opinion, there really is no better way than get it right into their living rooms. People have to understand it. You have to get it into the schools. You have to get it into the places where we work. People need to know that there's a connection between the world that we live in, what we use as far as energy, and how it's produced and where it's produced. And I think when we talk about a future with a smart grid, and we talk about a future where we have energy efficient, green, and smart buildings all connected together, what we've done there is we've produced a great story that will, in fact, translate down to the American people. When you start talking to the folks that can't afford $5 more, but right now, within their homes and in the world that they live in, they have embedded probably another $100 to $200 a month in savings that doesn't appear because their houses, their homes, their businesses, whatever it is, are inefficient. Right now, McKinsey study that came out not too long ago says there's about $160 billion just sitting on the table that we could grab by the year 2030 just by making the smallest improvements to the energy efficiency of these buildings. So I think we have a tremendous opportunity in front of us. I think the communications of this whole opportunity is going to be paramount, because when you talk about the grid, the average homeowner doesn't get it. I'm not sure they care. What they care about is food on the table, sending their kids to college. And when they start to realize that it's not just about them doing with less, but maybe some intelligent decisions about how their homes are operated, constructed, weatherized, and anything that has to do with improving that performance puts food on their table, I think that's one of the best messages we could sell. So that's it, Tim. Just a very quick comment on the on what we have in front of us.
Thank you very much, Rick. And I want to ask Carl Pope and Rose McKinney-James the question that you asked to begin with. Do people understand the connection between the energy they use and the world in which they live? Carl and Rose. Carl?
People understand it a lot better than they did even 24 months ago. And people like Boone Pickens and Al Gore and Bill Clinton get a lot of the credit for that. I was really struck as I went around. In 2006, when I went around campaigning, I could get an audience to talk about how green energy was a big part of the American economic future if I went to places like the Cleveland City Club. And that was news. I mean, prior to 2006, those of us who talked about this issue were by and large relegated to the free speech zone at national conventions. We weren't really a part of the mainstream dialogue. And in 2006, you started getting a serious hearing. This fall, I went out and I went to northeastern Ohio and I went door to door with canvassers for Working America in communities where steel jobs had gone away 20 years earlier. And I found that people at the door who'd been waiting for 20 years for something to happen finally thought something was going to happen. And they thought that something that was going to happen was wind turbines on Lake Erie. And they said to me at the door, look, we get it. If it can be made in Shanghai, it will be. But you can't harvest the wind on Lake Erie from Shanghai. If we're going to make my house more efficient, we're not going to do it in a backroom office in Bangalore. We're going to do it in Canton, Ohio, where I live. I think the American people are now way, way ahead of where their leaders were a year ago. But I think there is still a serious risk, and Secretary Chu talked about it. It's easy to talk about how government is bureaucratic, government slows things down, government's inefficient. When we're talking about connectivity, markets can be just as bad. They can sit forever maneuvering for advantage. They can sit forever arguing about standards. We can either build this new connected green energy world the way we built the interstate highway system, which I think is the right model, or we can build it the way we built the railroads. Now, eventually, out of the way we built the railroads, we got a pretty big railroad system. But it took an awfully long time and was very, very wasteful and inefficient. There was no plan. We didn't plan the railroad system. I think we need to plan the new energy future.
Great, Carl. Thank you very much. Rose, you've been a state regulator and an energy consultant and part of the Energy Foundation Board. Is the constituency there? And then we're going to go to Jeff Bingaman. Is the constituency being built there that's going to help Jeff Bingaman pass the energy legislation that's so critically needed? Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Senator. And on behalf of a variety of advocates in this room, from the state of Nevada, Senator Reid, before I begin, we certainly have to extend our appreciation for your extraordinary leadership in this regard. And for those of us who've been on the ground, literally for now a couple of decades, this is indeed an extraordinary opportunity. I think that we have, through the work over the last couple of decades, built for you a very strong network of advocates who understand these issues, who feel the pulse of the communities in which they work, and understand the challenges that we face with this current economy, looking forward to what they believe are the tremendous opportunities coming out of this technology. You know, I've been focusing on policies at the state level for a number of years, and we've put together what we think is a very strong framework, but it has become increasingly clear over time that what we really need is the federal leadership to make this happen. We absolutely need to have a plan, and we absolutely need to know that people on the ground are interested in the economic development opportunities for them. My colleagues at the Energy Foundation, as an example, have told me that if we can move toward serious planning for transmission, planning that will allow us on a regional basis to cooperate and bring together this network of advocates just in the state of Nevada alone, with two transmission lines, we could talk about up to 2,000 megawatts of renewable development, which would translate into 16,000 construction jobs, 1,000 of those in transmission alone, and then potentially 3,500 permanent jobs. That is meaningful. And the advocacy network that we have developed in large measure through philanthropy could serve as a strong partner for you in terms of making the advances that we need to achieve our long-term goal, which is outlined once again around the words on this table, clean energy, an abundant resource. And clearly in the state of Nevada, we have it all. We have geothermal, we have solar, we have a tremendous opportunity for biomass, which we've not discussed here in any large measure, but we have it, and we are ready and prepared to assist you in this regard.
Senator Bingaman, you've been listening to a lot of inputs and a lot of advice here. Hope this is helpful for your chore, and do you have the public support for doing what you have to do?
No, I think there's great public support and a great opportunity, obviously, to move toward a much more efficient system for use of energy, a much more clean system for production of energy and transmission of energy. And we need to sort through the difficult questions of jurisdiction between the states and the federal government. We need to be sure that the necessary authority exists at the national level to do some of this planning that we've been talking about as so essential and that Carl referred to. And then I think we do have to be sure that we do it in a way that helps us use the grid in the smartest possible way, because the great, as everyone recognizes and many have said around here, President Clinton said it very well, the greatest near-term opportunity is in saving energy. We can become much more efficient in the way we use energy, and the smart grid will allow us to do that if we just have the wit to figure out what the elements are that will get us to a smart grid. So I congratulate you on this conference and everyone who's participated. I think there's a strong consensus to move ahead aggressively, and I hope we're able to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, and that is a good summary for a momentary pause. We had promised our good secretaries a noontime witching hour, and I know that Secretary Salazar and Secretary Chu have another session that they have to go to for a lunch, and we'd promised our senators as well a similar time frame. So let me see if I can just sort of set the engagement for the remaining time together. We would like to get Michael Thaman from Owens Corning to talk some about some of the technologies that are available, and ask Nat Simons to give us a bit of a view on his perspective of the role of outside philanthropy and advocacy to get this to happen. And then close with Vice President Gore and Boone Pickens, and finally John Podesta.